stories, the Taliban capture Lashkargah in southwestern Afghanistan as the U.S. and Britain deploy thousands of troops to the country to evacuate their nationals. China rejects the World Health Organization's calls for a new probe into the origins of COVID-19, saying it supports scientific over political efforts to find out how the virus started. Russia reports 815 new deaths from the coronavirus, recording its highest daily fatality since the start of the pandemic. Welcome to the program. Taliban militants say they have captured Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province, in southern Afghanistan. A security source has confirmed the news, saying military and government officials had evacuated Lashkargah after striking a deal with the Taliban. The militants have seized over a dozen provincial capitals since last Friday as they press ahead with their offensive across Afghanistan. The group is estimated to be in control of nearly two-thirds of the country. The capital, Kabul, remains in the hands of the government. Thousands of civilians have already fled there as the Taliban took key cities one by one. Meanwhile, the U.S. and U.K. say they are deploying thousands of troops to help evacuate their nationals and diplomats leaving Afghanistan. Our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alemi, gave us an update or more details about the Taliban taking control of provincial capitals in Afghanistan.
The situation is worsening. The insecurity is worsening day by day in Afghanistan due to the expansion of Taliban attacks across this country. Based on official reports, Lashkargah, the capital city of the southern Helmand province of Afghanistan, is under the control of Taliban militants, and the Taliban could capture this strategic city in southern Afghanistan after weeks of fighting with Afghan security forces, especially commando troops who were stationed there. Prior to the collapse of the Lashkargah, or the capital of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan, the commander of 2015 Afghan National Army Corps, General Sadat, who was responsible for security of not only the city of Lashkargah, but also for the entire province, as well as for the province of Nimruz. In the meantime, the Taliban also claims to have captured the Lurgar district, located in southwest of Kabul, according to Taliban spokesman Agru. The Taliban militants have entered the city of Pule Alam, the center of the capital of this province, that is located very close to the Afghan capital, Kabul. In the meantime, Ghazni, another strategic city that is located 150 kilometers south of Kabul, is also under the control of the Taliban. And the Taliban has only made on Wardak province on the way to reach to Kabul.
Iran has called on the Taliban to ensure the safety of diplomats and diplomatic facilities in the Afghan city of Herat. The call followed a Taliban announcement that they have gained control over the city. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said his country is in regular contact with its consulate in Herat and follow up the condition of the staff there. Said Khatibzadeh also expressed concern about the escalation of violence in Afghanistan and the condition of civilians. He urged the Taliban to ensure their safety. Herat is Afghanistan's third largest city and fell to the Taliban Thursday. Iranians have reacted to the release of a photo of the Russian and British ambassadors in Tehran. In the next report, we will tell you why the picture has triggered an acrimonious backlash.
A controversial photo taken at the Russian embassy in Tehran has angered Iranians. The picture posted online by the Russian embassy this week has drawn widespread criticism and growing calls for an official apology. The controversial photo depicts Russian Ambassador Levan Jagarian and his British counterpart Simon Shercliffe sitting on the porch of the embassy with a third empty chair. It clearly echoes a photo taken in 1943 of Allied leaders Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt at exactly the same location. The Allied leaders met at the Tehran Conference to coordinate strategy against Nazi Germany. At the time, Iran was occupied by Russian and British forces, despite its neutrality in the Second World War. The 1943 conference at the Russian embassy is seen by many Iranians as a violation of Iran's sovereignty and independence. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, led a chorus of sharp criticism, describing the photo as, quote, extremely inappropriate. On Thursday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British and Russian envoys over the release of the picture online. The envoys were told at the ministry that the posting was totally unacceptable. The Russian and British diplomats insist that no harm was intended and that the picture was a tribute to the fight against Nazi Germany.
Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the humanitarian crisis in the war-torn country. Our correspondent, Abdul Latif al-Washali, tells us more.
To show its goodwill to find a peaceful solution to the years-long crisis in Yemen, Yemen's Ansarullah has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the current crisis. The spokesman of Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdus Salam, said the initiative includes stopping the Yemeni army's operations in Marib, reactivating the Marib gas station to generate electricity for all Yemen, and forming a joint administration from the people of Marib to maintain security and expel the terrorist groups from the city.
The initiative launched by Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi is aimed to stop war in Marib. The people of Marib should have the final say when it comes to their political fate. Meanwhile, the roads must be open for the free movement of Yemenis. This initiative is an appropriate measure that will benefit the Yemeni people and establish a comprehensive political and economic solution to the current crisis.
The free movement of all Yemenis, Abdus Salam said, should be guaranteed, as well as the release of all the detainees from the prisons of the Saudi-backed forces in Marib. Ansarullah's initiative came in conjunction with the UN's appointment of Hans Grundberg of Sweden as its new envoy for Yemen.
Many here say changing the UN envoy will not solve the problem because, as things stand, this is the US which controls the situation and leads the war on Yemen behind the scene. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
China has rejected the World Health Organization's calls for a renewed probe into the origins of COVID-19. Beijing says the calls are politically motivated. On Thursday, the WHO urged China to share raw data from the earliest COVID cases to revive its probe into the origins of the disease. The organization carried out a first investigation in January when its team visited the Chinese city of Wuhan. That's where the first global infections emerged. In its report, the WHO said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that a lab leak caused the pandemic, but it failed to conclude how the virus began. Now, China says that same report should be the basis of a future global traceability work. Russia has recorded 850 new deaths from COVID-19, the highest daily fatality rate since the pandemic began. The latest figure brings to over 168,000 the number of total virus deaths in Russia. The health ministry also announced more than 22,200 new daily cases on Friday. Russia has been grappling with a third wave of the disease since mid-June. The authorities blame the resurgence on the highly contagious Delta variant. 42% of the Russian population has been fully vaccinated, but independent polls show that 55% of Russians do not plan on getting a jab. Australia's state of New South Wales has reported its biggest daily rise of coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. Officials warned that infections could surge in the coming days.
We had, unfortunately, 390 cases of community transmission. Some are still under investigation, but at least 60 of those have been infectious in the community. And I anticipate, given the large number of cases we've had in the last few days, that unfortunately this trend will continue for at least the next few days.
The authorities also reported 2 new deaths. They bring to 38 the total fatalities from the latest outbreak in New South Wales. The state's capital, Sydney, is the hardest hit. Infections have spiked there despite a nearly 7-week lockdown. The restrictions were imposed after a Delta-driven outbreak in the city in mid-June. The virus has even spread to other parts of Australia, prompting officials to impose similar curbs. On Friday, the capital, Canberra, entered its first day of a week-long lockdown after it reported 2 cases. The lockdown is the first there in more than a year. Iran has logged more than 39,000 new COVID-19 infections, bringing the country's total caseload to nearly 4.4 million. The health ministry also confirmed 527 new COVID-related deaths for the past day. The country's total death toll from the virus is now inching closer to 97,000. More than 7,000 COVID patients are currently in intensive care units. Iran has been grappling with a 5th wave of the pandemic for weeks now. The surge is likely or largely blamed on the Delta variant of the virus. More than 330 cities are now designated as red, the highest category on Iran's coronavirus risk scale. COVID restrictions are in place in those cities to curb the outbreak. Nearly 14.5 million people have received the first dose of a COVID vaccine nationwide. More than 3.6 million have so far been fully inoculated. North Korea has slammed the U.S. and South Korea for going ahead with military exercises, saying they will counter such aggression with their own quote-unquote substantial deterrent. Our very own Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region. And this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place, experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they're described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang. The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
With the beginning of the lunar month of Muharram, Muslims from all walks of life in Kashmir have joined hands to mourn the martyrdom anniversary of the 3rd Shia Imam and grandson of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Hussein. They hold their mourning ceremonies annually, despite restrictions imposed by the Indian-controlled Kashmir administration. A correspondent, Shahanabad, reports.
Black posters, banners with messages from the battlefield of Karbala, and black and red flags have been upped in different parts of Muslim-majority Kashmir as people observe the lunar month of Muharram. Muharram is observed across the Shia world in memory of the martyrdom of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein on the battlefield of Karbala while fighting the evil force of Yazid some 1400 years ago. Ever since the onset of Islam in Kashmir, the ceremonies of Muharram have been observed here. Despite the changing times, the enthusiasm to commemorate the greatest sacrifice for humanity remains intact. Shakil Ahmed Khan is a visual artist by profession. For the past 40 years, during the holy month of Muharram, he has used his art as a medium to tell the tales from the battlefield of Karbala. He says his spiritual connection with the religion of Islam revives with each stroke of his brush on the black banners. Each year, Shakil makes dozens of banners and posters. He says his art helps him to connect to the younger generation.
When the banners and posters are done, a team of youngsters is given the responsibility to place them in different parts of the city. But before they take them, I narrate to them the importance of these lessons. And in this way, the message keeps moving on.
Groups of youngsters from different areas of the Muslim majority region take the responsibility of managing events and ceremonies, and this way they believe they have joined the great army of Imam Hussein's mission. Scores of youths have gathered to raise the tallest black flag in the capital city of Srinagar. They say this flag represents our sentiments and is a reminder to take forward the mission for which our great Imam gave his life.
Black represents mourning, and thereby raising this flag, we have a number of messages. First, we are the mourners of Imam Hussein. Second, no oppressor on this earth can debtor our faith in the values and principles of Islam. And third, it reminds us of our commitment to spread the teachings of Imam Hussein.
3 decades of political instability in the region have resulted in restrictions on such religious events. New Delhi recently lifted the 3-decade-old ban on Muharram processions in Kashmir, but soon revised the decision and placed the ball in the local administration's court. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EM.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein's Mubahala, sacrificing his dearest ones to rise up on the path of God. August 30th, 2020. This is a short part of a Dars-e-Kharij-e Fiqh lecture delivered on the eve of Muharram on March 12th, 2002. People who were eloquent, fluent speakers, prominent figures, important personages of the Bani Hashim and Quraysh, and famous young people from the early years of Islam, each of whom had an honorable history, did not dare to take any noticeable action, let alone ordinary people. This was true not only in the Levant, but even in Medina itself. Then compare the situation in Medina with other places that did not enjoy the same centrality. There was an unbelievable environment of oppression. Imam Hussein's uprising in such a situation was to break this domination. Imam Hussein's movement was aimed at breaking this domination, but not with the intention of seeking power. I did not move with wicked, wrong, unjust, or corrupt intentions. He did not rise like others who rise up, move, strike, and kill. He did not want to take power. Rather, he wished to enjoin good and forbid evil. 2 outcomes were possible for him. One was that he would win, and the other was that he would be killed. Considering the tragic situation that could be imagined for him, even without the Imam's special knowledge, well, it was clear they would show no consideration for him.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance, September 27th, 2017.
In such a situation, Imam Hussein did the same thing that the Holy Prophet did with the Christians, which is referred to in the verses of Mubahala in the Holy Quran. These days, we are close to the days of Mubahala. That is, he brought his children, his female family members, and himself into the field. That is, he took his dearest wealth and all his possessions to defend the truth and to rise up on the path of God. And then he waited. The patience of Imam Hussein is very important. I once gave a detailed speech about Imam Hussein's patience. But now there is not enough time for this discussion. We cannot understand what patience means. The real meaning of patience becomes clear in its real place. Many people from among the respected elders, the narrators of hadith, prominent figures, respected people, wise men, caring and somewhat caring individuals, kept coming to Imam Hussein and saying, "Sir, in doing this, you are engaging in a useless action, hurting yourself and the household of the Prophet, and humiliating the people of truth." They were saying such things.
At dawn on Thursday, August 5, while we were safely sleeping in our beds, Israeli enemy planes sent its warplanes to terrorize us in South Lebanon. After a full day of mortar shells on Wednesday that were as close as 1 kilometer away from my village house, we woke up terrified a few hours later at dawn at the sound of air raids that shook the entire south. For the first time since 2006, thanks to the deterrence equation imposed by the Lebanese resistance that has been in effect for the past 15 years, Israel bombed an open uninhabited area near the town of Mahmoudiya between the districts of Jizin, Marjayoun, and Nabatiye. Tel Aviv claimed it was a response to the firing of rockets from southern Lebanon towards northern occupied Palestine, while perfectly knowing it was not Hezbollah who fired those rockets. Hint, if it were Hezbollah, all of those rockets would have reached their targets, Hence, it was another resistance faction with humble capabilities who gave their all to support their brothers and sisters in Sheikh Jarrah, just as they did during the Sword of Al-Quds operation in May. Israel crossed red lines and violated the rules of engagement established since 2006. Israel was counting on the resistance to let it go and not respond to the raid. But as usual, Israel came out unprepared and in full surprise when they hit back with hard and precise retaliation from the Lebanese Islamic Resistance. Hezbollah was able to reiterate the deterrence equation and the rules of engagement that govern the Southern Front against the Israeli enemy. The resistance benefited from the error of Israel's assessments, which estimated before its raid on open areas deep inside the south that the Lebanese economic hardships would allow the Zionist occupation forces to bypass these rules and equations. The Israeli error was based on a misunderstanding of how much the economic and financial challenges in Lebanon can influence Hezbollah's retaliation. This motivated Israel to persist in its response to the recent rockets that fell in the northern part of occupied Palestine, which allowed it to use the air force to bomb Lebanese lands in return, albeit with caution that it was not inhabited. Israel repeated the same mistake it made last May in the Palestinian arena, as it estimated that the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip would not intervene to protect the rights of Al-Quds Palestinian natives against constant Israeli aggression. Yet Operation Sword of Al-Quds rained retaliatory fire on Israel, which ended with a large basket of losses to Tel Aviv. As a result, Hezbollah asserted its defensive equation in the face of Israel, clarifying the latter's limitations and emphasizing them. Meanwhile, Israel suffered a loss that is not without negative repercussions on strategic levels regarding its defensive and offensive stances on the Lebanese front. Although the results of what happened are not necessarily limited to Lebanon, but also extend to all regions of confrontation. Welcome to the Middle East stream, I'm Marwa Osman. In a dangerous development for the security scene in South Lebanon, Israeli warplanes launched two raids at dawn on Thursday, August 5th, on the Damascus area in the outskirts of the town of Mahmoudieh between the districts of Jezzine, Marjayoun, and Nabatieh. The two raids targeted uninhabited areas, but Israeli media claimed it was the area from which rockets were launched the day before, targeting Kiryat Shmona illegal settlement in occupied Palestine. Now, although the Israeli placed a raid in the context of responding to rockets fired towards Palestine, yet the attack crosses all the red lines which are established by the rules of engagement in South Lebanon since the end of the July War 2006. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Radwan Murtada, veteran journalist at Lebanese Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for being with us. So, Mr. Radwan, what if Hezbollah did not respond to abolish the new equation that the enemy tried to impose on the Lebanese arena? What is the extent of the next Israeli aggression had Hezbollah not retaliated to this one?
Experiences with the Israeli enemy have proven that if they strike and they were not stricken back, I mean, for retaliation, they would repeat so. In the past, the Israeli enemy used to say that they could occupy Lebanon with a musical band, and every time they had the chance, they would strike Lebanon. And these strikes went on up till the occupation of the capital, Beirut, in 1982 invasion, and settling in more than one area in Lebanon. But with the experience of the resistance, this formula has changed. The resistance has established a deterrence equation that if you strike us, if you hit us, we're going to hit you back. This was more established after the July 2006 war. There was the war of the Israeli withdrawal 2000 and then the 2004. And what was produced and what resulted from this war. So the equation situation was as such that if you had open land, we will do the same. And now, if you kill one of our civilians, we'll kill your civilians. If you kill one of our freedom fighters, we will kill your group. So that was the experience when the Israeli enemy had a convoy of the resistance within Syria. Two martyrs were killed. And then Sayyid Nasrullah, Hassan Nasrullah, made a speech that we will let the Israeli enemy stand on one leg and a half, and they will have to wait for our retaliation. So sometimes they use the effigies in order to make Hezbollah believe that these were troops. But
what Israel did is it repeated the mistake it did last May in the Palestinian arena. It repeated it the same on Lebanon when it estimated that the resistance factions in Gaza will not be retaliating to support their brothers and sisters of Sheikh Jarrah. Are these errors the results of maybe defects in the structure of the intelligence analysis and the assessment models of the Israeli intelligence establishment? And how will this affect the Israeli future engagement, whether in Lebanon or elsewhere?
Certainly, this was a mistake. And miscalculation, misassessment, if you will, as for the reaction due to the sword of Al-Quds, the Israelis waged a war against Gaza, and they failed. They lost that war. If you go back to the comments of the Israeli army, all the analysts who are close to the Israeli army know, first they confirmed that there was a mistake, there was a wrong assessment, and these analysts who are usually close to the Israeli army usually avoid to criticize directly the Israeli army, but this time they did. You have Lilach Shuval, and she's one of the analysts who are close to the Israeli army. She says that once again it turned out that the Israeli assessment was wrong. First they assessed that Hezbollah will not retaliate to the Israeli attack on South Lebanon, and they did everything in order not to draw a blowback from Hezbollah. There was a comment by Lethal Brown. He says that the assessment was that Hezbollah will not retaliate, on the Israeli attack and the Palestinian group. So therefore, Israel was not ready to receive those missiles. So this scene demonstrates that there is a confusion, but Hezbollah has re-established this.
What will exactly be the repercussions for Lebanon in the event that Israel increases its aggression and maybe starts a confrontation in parallel with the economic and financial hardships right now in Lebanon that would ignite further the Lebanese public? And by the way, these hardships are ignited in Lebanon by, not to say maybe friends of Israel, but at least people who are pro-Israeli policies against Lebanon.
First of all, I would have a reservation as for the term of friends of Israel. This was the case when there was the Lahad army, the SLA. Today, now we have parties that may disagree as for the issue of the friend of Israel and the enemy. Who is the friend and who is the enemy? What is taking place in the field has a political dimension. The evidence to what I'm saying is the visit by the Israeli war minister, Benny Gantz. So he wanted the French to use the crisis, economic crisis in Lebanon, and to have a condition in order to provide Lebanon with assistance that Hezbollah needs to stop the precision missiles that Hezbollah is developing. So they showed that Hezbollah is preoccupied with all these crises, and also there was an environment that is criticizing Hezbollah and are turning against Hezbollah. But it turned out that you have to take into account that Hezbollah does not represent all of the resistance. There were other groups of resistance. They offered martyrs in this regard. So would this lead to a further attack? Possible, but every strike will be met with another. This is what was
and take such a blow by Israel in the event of the economic hardship?
First, the Israeli army was clear because they were sort of justifying the Hezbollah's action, that they were saying that there were no Israeli civilians fell, and such war, they know that it's a lost war. They had this, the experience of the sort of Al-Quds war, and in spite of all the siege that is imposed on the Gaza people, so they, how can they engage with Hezbollah, who has more arms, has no siege against it, and has a huge amount of 150,000 rockets, and also the expertise that was Hezbollah achieved in Syria. So I think that the Israeli enemy will not dare to engage in war against them.
I want to thank you, Mr. Murtada. Please stay with us. We will keep talking about this matter in the second segment of the show. And please stay tuned. We will have more to talk about the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. Israel was counting on the resistance failure to respond to its first raid since 2006. The Israeli assessment was based on its theory that Hezbollah is deterred as a result of various factors, most notably the stifling economic crisis in Lebanon and the internal political conditions. However, the resistance surprised the enemy and fired dozens of missiles towards open lands near enemy positions in the occupied Shabak farms. Israel was again deterred. Now, the highly complex equation is very simple at the same time, and the result is that the resistance has re-established its red lines. It is forbidden for the occupying army to attack Lebanese territory, and the enemy should not bet on the resistance preoccupation at home or on its deterrence. Israel retreats in Lebanon in this following report. Last week, Israel seemed to be at war with itself over the narrative that it wanted to deliver to its audience with a mission that aims to reduce the possible losses it sustained after Hezbollah's missile response leading to Israel's retraction. In contrast to the noticeable political silence with zero threats, which are usually a prerequisite for the official Israeli approach to any confrontation, the Israeli occupation forces spokesman Ran Kohav was busy trying to demonstrate what he referred to as, quote, indications that Hezbollah is not interested in a confrontation with Israel, unquote, adding that Israel is, wait for it, studying appropriate ways to respond to Hezbollah's retaliatory strikes, then stressing that, quote, all parties do not want war. Yep, he said that. Ran said that Israel, the same Israel that carpet bombed Gaza 3 months ago, does not want war. The reaction of Israel's leaders, both political and military, following Hezbollah's missile response to the enemy's air raid at dawn on Thursday, August 5, was remarkable. Many meetings, a few statements, and zero actions. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett called an emergency meeting of senior officials at the War Ministry headquarters in Tel Aviv, including War Minister Benny Gantz, Israeli Occupation Forces Chief of Staff Aviv Kohavi, and others to discuss, get this, Israel's options. In turn, Gantz held a situation assessment session with Kohavi and the head of the Israeli Occupation Forces Operations Division, Oded Basyuk. In addition to the head of the Intelligence Division, Tamir Heyman, devoted to discussing Israel's practical options to respond to Hezbollah's retaliation. However, no results came out of the meetings, paralleled by Israeli field withdrawals, indicating the limitations of Israel's options. Perhaps what was mentioned in Gantz's call with his American counterpart, Lloyd Austin, although the call was pre-planned and initially not related to Hezbollah's response, was remarkable in its implications. According to Zionist media, Gantz said during the call with Austin that, quote, Israel is asking the international community and the United States in particular to demand the Lebanese government to stop firing rockets at Israel, end quote. This demand was sufficient in its implications, notably that the Israeli occupation is requesting its American buddies to get involved to stop Hezbollah's retaliatory rockets instead of taking the usual aggressive matters into their own hands. Hence, in addition to Hezbollah's success along with its allies in thwarting the new Middle East plan by confronting its Lebanese and Syrian tools, it is now more than evident that Hezbollah has also succeeded since the great 2006 victory in thwarting this same plan by confronting its Israeli tool at the Lebanese gate towards Palestine. Now we are back at the Middle East stream with Radwan Murtada, veteran journalist at Lebanese Al-Akhbar daily newspaper. Now, Mr. Radwan, the task seemed not easy for Tel Aviv in the wake of Hezbollah's response. Its decision was moving between two limits here. It wants a response that does not lead to losses on the Lebanese side so as not to cause retaliation, but at the same time, it sought some sort of an attack in a way that would not lead to an escalation that would further be increased into a confrontation. How can Israel achieve any results, if I may, when it's stuck between these two extremes?
Israel tries to remain within these two edges, or these two extremes, or tried in its last attack to be between these two extremes. This was uncovered with the comments of the commentators who are close to the Israeli army, but it's clear that Israel has failed. Israel expected that Hezbollah will not retaliate because Hezbollah is in crisis, but even after the retaliation, there was more than international mediators, UN mediators. They delivered the message that to the Lebanese side that the issue is over. Now, what if the issue developed and Israel made a mistake and there were no asymmetric similar retaliation? What if Israel made a mistake that caused larger retaliation? Would things stop there, or would things develop into a real confrontation? It is my opinion that Hezbollah, Israel is not ready to this confrontation, but and Hezbollah does not want it, but if it was imposed on Hezbollah, Hezbollah will engage it.
Well, after the 2006 victory, it was always present in Israel's calculations whenever it was considering the option of war, at least confrontation against Hezbollah. The latter's developed capabilities, their tactics, their missiles, which are, by the way, established by the resistance and were proven to be valid in combat, whether it was in Syria or in Iraq. If the shadow of the 2006 war changed the equation of the conflict with the Israeli enemy, what do you think last week's resistance retaliation brought forth to the whole regional confrontation with Israel?
Since the year 2011 and after the event of the so-called Arab Spring, the Islamic resistance of Hezbollah has engaged in a huge military experience in Syria and in Iraq and acquired huge expertise in this regard. Israel was viewing this with concern and regarded that this experience will be reflected or maybe repeated in any confrontation or battle in the future. Especially as Hezbollah, on more than one occasion, the Secretary General of the party threatened Israel that in the next coming confrontation, we will go into the Galilee. But in spite of all that is being said, Hezbollah says we only want to liberate our land. We will observe the drone borders. But if there is any aggression, we will retaliate to that, and we will keep maintain supporting the Palestinian resistance. The recent retaliation was to re-establish this equation of deterrence. Even if Hezbollah with its complete military, Hezbollah needs to re-establish and to consolidate this deterrence equation, that even whatever has changed, even the economic crisis, will not change anything in our plans in the as far as the confrontation.
Well, something very interesting happened at the end of the mission, where a group of Shwaya residents in Hasbaya in South Lebanon shared a video of themselves surrounding a truck carrying a missile launcher and arresting and harassing as well. the fighters, the resistance fighters who were riding in the truck and in the car accompanying it after they finalized their mission against the Israeli entity on the border with Palestine. That was a very unpleasant precedent that brought condemnation from all across Lebanon. Who's to say that this won't happen again in other villages where at least there are a couple of groups that are anti-Hezbollah? Or at least who's to say that this will not be the way to ignite Lebanon all over again?
First, what happened in Shuaya was not the first time it happened, because during the July confrontation, there were vehicles of the resistance that were intercepted. But what happened in Shuaya has some dangerous signs, meaning the way of attacking the resistance fighters and taking the footage and claiming that the resistance is firing from civilian areas. And Israel is rushing to accept it and take this and to say that the environment of Hezbollah is rejecting Hezbollah and they are opposing its actions. But there is one positive lining that some of the Shuaya people had their two or three of the resistance fighters. They were hidden, and the people from Shuaya, so part of the Shuaya residents were against what happened and the attack against the resistance. So the question was, said Hassan Nasrallah, what if this happens again? So Sayyid Nasrallah said that they need to be taken to court. Their names are there, their images are there, photos are there. And also he expressed how much he was affected or impressed by what happened, or affected emotionally. He's saying that if the state does not take action in this regard, meaning when the state shows negligence, we will see what needs to be done, because those who launch aggression aggress against the resistance are as if collaborating with the Israeli enemy. It's clear that it is a pure political accusation. It is clear that there is a sort of operation room that are trying to promote this accusation, because the Lebanese forces and the Lebanese Kataib are the ones accusing Hezbollah in this regard. And some media outlets try to promote this. But as long as, since the Americans, and they are the number one enemy to the Hezbollah, the French, the British, and the Lebanese authorities, they are all saying unanimously that there was no external aggression. It was not because of an explosive bomb. And there was nothing other than the material that was stored in this section of the port. So this shows that Hezbollah has nothing to do. When he was criticizing Bifar, the judge who was investigating this, he was saying, declare whatever you have. So some say that the justice is slow as a circle, but others say no, the justice that is slow is one that is not incomplete, because it allows the accusation of innocent people. As for the nitrate issue, to say that this nitrate were to Hezbollah, to Syria, sorry, there is no need to say this, because Syria can produce these and manufacture these nitrates. It is something that they were used by the militias in Syria that were against the regime. And reports show that jihadists were using these materials, because it was difficult for them to get to DMT and Expo and everything like that. So why would Hezbollah, the Syrian regime, go to something that is used in agriculture in order to use it as a weapon?
Well, I want to thank you very much, Radwan Murtada, veteran journalist at Lebanese Al-Akhbar Daily newspaper, for joining us to discuss the ongoing developments in Lebanon, especially the new development of Israel targeting Lebanese territory with an air raid after 15 years of total deterrence. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting two special guests. And without further ado, we're going to begin with our introduction and jump straight into our discussion. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, Sayyid.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Salam, bro.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, Sayyid. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you.
Brother Yasir from South Africa.
Thank you for being with us, Sayyid.
Sayyid Abdullah Musa from Australia.
All right. Thank you so very much for joining us, gentlemen. Muharram is a month that as an ummah we all get together, we mourn Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam in great congregations and gatherings, and depending on which region of the world you're from, the rituals are really, you know, they're different and they're very like clustered most of the time, right? And because we've been dealing with a pandemic for the past 2 years, social distancing is really important. And the question today is, should we carry on the majalis the way we've always done, regardless of the Ronas? Or should we continue adhering to the protocols like we did last year in most parts of the world, risk other things?
As you mentioned, there's been a year of experience throughout the world. People in different parts have been through this kind of pandemic, the majalis during the pandemic, and how to go about doing it. Mm-hmm. So this is like a second go at it, to see whether or not can it be improved on or not. Like the last Muharram that we had, a lot of the majalis were online.
Yes.
One of the advantages of this was that it created a platform for more people to reach more people.
Mm.
It's one of the advantages, not saying it is the advantage, but it's one of the, if you want to call it, sub-advantages. Like, for example, you had people in Africa, for listening to majalises in Canada or in America, live, right?
Yep.
Not like recorded or an audio clip being sent.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was live, and you could listen to it and you could watch it, and it was intended for an audience to do that, mm-hmm. a live majalis online, which a lot of people started doing in all over the world. For example, you had speakers from here. I know one person who spoke in 5 different countries
mm-hmm.
at one time. It was an advantage.
It was.
But always do you have the disadvantage of that human touch. There isn't, you know, that type of closeness, that type of attachment, that type of gathering. You know, the concept of jama'ah in its, you know, lowest form of being together in a place at a particular time, performing the same act, it has importance.
Definitely does.
And that has importance as well, but... you know, in Iran, for example, they had certain gatherings that they were able to, or certain other countries as well, where they have the capacity and the capability to perform these majalises in a huge hall. I'm sure we saw
it
last time.
Yeah, or
right?
Open space.
And it had
like
blocks and boxes where people had to sit.
A few feet of distance between each person.
Yeah, but obviously when it comes to a particular time in the majalis, that kind of goes away. So people don't follow it anymore because that's what happens. But as you know, the leaders and the maharaja and the scholars have said to follow the advice of the medical practitioners. In some countries also to follow the advice and the protocols of the certain countries you're in may be beneficial. Maybe.
Because really, they don't have any other choice. But Sayed, what do you think? Because some say that, you know what, never mind protocols when it comes to Aba Abdullah, we do it the traditional way, right? Question is, why do they have that opinion regarding this matter?
Why would they hold such an opinion? Well, I can't speak on their behalf. But if I want to speak as an extremist myself, when it comes to the Azza of Aba Abdullah, we seem to have a history that when it comes to Abu Abdullah alayhi salam, we give all.
Obviously.
So the soul or the nafs, it becomes cheap when it comes to Abu Abdullah. So considering the fact that the Islam itself, in the word of Imam Khomeini, he said, Muharram Ansar preserved Islam for us. If we cut that link, if we sever that link between people and Muharram and we make it just an online commodity or something that if you afterward you can just turn on the online and watch it, which is pretty much it loses the spirit of Muharram itself. Then what is there left, right? So if you're
telling me you're totally against this.
I'll get to that. I don't want you to understand me wrong. First, I want to go to the intro kind of thing. So you remember the Abbasids when people started attending the Imam Hussein's? No, when they were going to Imam Hussein's grave. The Abbasid, they tried every single way they could think of to stop people from attending or going to the shrine of the Imam alayhi salam. To the extent they were giving people the ultimatum, you can go, but you have to give a limb, a hand or a leg. So people were lining up. Okay, you take my hand. The second year they would come, like, okay, you took my hand last time, you can take the second one. And people were persistent, right?
And then what?
Hussein alayhi salam continued to echo through the ages.
Yeah, but then that person loses both their arms and they can't make a livelihood for their family anymore.
Now, everyone has, obviously, does it on his own capacity. Everyone has a special capacity. For example, I know
what
myself.
What does that verse mean, even? What is that
Allah
verse?
Will burden you with something that more than you can cope, right? So, for example, if I want to attend the majaz for Abu Abdullah alayhi salam and I want to make that statement that, you know, they should not be cut. Obviously, you're not going to have the whole Shia masses going and getting their limbs cut off. There are those who will make that statement to prove to the tyrants that, you know, we will continue kind of thing.
Right. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
Oh, shahidan to ya Hussein. Oh, arsar khan to ya Hussein. آه دلم اسرت کربلا آه کربلا کربلا کربلا
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to Back to Reality. Here in the studio, we're discussing the concept of having majalis for Muharram and Safar, which are upon us, while following COVID protocols and how functional that is, how beneficial that is, or how right that even is. So, Sayyidina, your opening was that I go to extremes. I don't necessarily like that word, but I go to extremes when it comes to Aba Abdullah and Hussein alayhi salam. And it's fair to say that almost every lover of Aba Abdullah is like that. It's the quality of Aba Abdullah. He brings out that extreme in all of us. Maybe the extreme in these circumstances is to withhold from that longing we have for the majalis and do the right thing by social distancing. How do you know your yearning for the majalis is not your nafs?
All right, so the thing that I did not get to say, considering that I said we, you know, we have to maintain attending the majalis. That was the statement I was trying to make without going to technicalities. The other thing is, considering that we live in a very, how should I put the word, extreme circumstances, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very unnatural circumstances that we live in. Obviously,